And tonight, we have yet another sterling journalist, one who's dedicated his entire life to shining the truth on shrouded events. That gentleman, as you all know, is Seymour Hersh. Mr. Hersh first gained worldwide recognition in 1969 for exposing the My Lai massacre and its cover-up during the Vietnam War, for which he received the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting. His 1983 book, The Price of Power, Kissinger in the Nixon White House, won him the National Book Critics Circle Award and the LA Times Book Prize in Biography. He has 7 other equally notable books to his credits. I think I've read 6. Mr. Hersh contributes regularly to The New Yorker on military and security matters. And earlier this year, an article investigated exactly how Vice President Dick Cheney and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld circumvented the normal intelligence analysis function of the CIA in their quest to make a case for the 2003 invasion of Iraq. His coverage of Richard Perle in another article led Perle to say that Hersh was, quote, the closest thing American journalism has to a terrorist. And then Mr. Perle threatened to sue him. And this past May, of course, we all know that Mr. Hersh and The New Yorker were the courageous ones who were the first to publish a series of articles describing and showing the photos of torture by U.S. military police of prisoners at the Iraqi prison of Abu Ghraib. Of the school that the story is more important than me in journalism, Mr. Hersh declined to be interviewed last month upon receiving the 2004 National Magazine Award for Public Interest. Oh my God, this is so tedious, he told the Washington Post reporter who asked about his personal background in 2001. He said, it doesn't have the F word, but it's one of the other words. He said, what the hell does it have to do with anything I write, said Mr. Hersh. That's why he's taking the time to join us here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Seymour Hersh, a living legend.
You know, the truth is, and let me know if you have trouble with me in the mic, the truth is that, I don't know how you'll do it, but try. The truth is, it's so ironic listening to John Sayles. I was thinking, I was thinking that the best information we may get about this election may come from a combination of Control Room, Fahrenheit 9/11, John Sayles, the nightly news from John Stewart, if some of you watch that. At the height of the prisoner abuse stories, he had as one of his mock news broadcasters say very seriously to the camera on the Stewart show, he said, the important thing is not that we commit torture and abuses, is that we're a country that doesn't condone torture and abuses. That's what's a wonderful line. And so, you start talking about failures of communication. I don't know where we're going to go with this. I can't make you feel happy about where we are. We've got a very important election coming up, probably the most important since, 1860? I think it is. And there's nothing I can say to you about any of that. I can tell you... I was thinking earlier that in the height of all this stuff, you know, we do live with humor in America, dark humor. Philip Roth sent an email to David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker. In the midst, I think there were 3 stories we wrote about all this terrible stuff that's going on. And he said 2 points he wanted to make. He said, one, he said they're great stories. And two, he said, There's some pictures of photographs of me and my girlfriend. Perhaps you guys might want to publish. Only he. So here we are. The bottom line is, by the way, I'm in a tough position because I'm not done reporting on all this. And so we're going to do some questions, and as long as you give me, because, you know, everybody, you don't want to hear too much of this stuff, but I'll do questions. I'll just tell you what's on my mind. It's a tough position because there is more to the story. And I'll tell you the simple way. I guess the way to describe how you look at things is, I don't know about you, but I have a wife and children, and one of the things that makes life livable is trusting in my partner and never lying to my children and never wanting my children, with the exception of teenage girls, to lie to me about anything. I did echo those comments earlier about children and parenting, but anyway. But basically, you know what I'm talking about. It's the core of how we exist. The way we live, and not us, there's nothing special about us. Everybody in the world, we all live. The most important thing in our life is our family structure and the integrity with which we live and the honesty with which we conduct our life and the trust with which we have people. And if you think about it, you begin to understand the bad bargain we have. It's a condition, a requirement, that one we so desperately live in our own families with that we don't even begin to levy on the President of the United States and the National Security Advisor. It's not even a requirement. We don't even have any expectation that they're going to have the same trust and integrity in conducting their affairs as we do in our own personal life. It's a bad bargain for us in the Commonweal. We don't even begin. We understand what they are. And you heard talking about Henry Kissinger, who, for all of his genius, lied like most of us breathe. And there, when you're in a situation like that, is that partisan or nonpartisan? I don't know. But but you don't begin, you know, it's really a bad bargain. And we live with it pretty happily. We go along, okay, another president, another national security advisor, Condi Rice in this case. And we know we don't get the story. And what do they have the right to do? They have the right to send our children, men and women now, in the name of democracy, to go kill and be killed and to torture. And perhaps be tortured in return, which is always going to be the end result of torture. I think there's nothing wrong with holding these people to the highest possible standards. It doesn't happen enough, but that's what we have to do. We don't know. I'll tell you right now the reason I'm saying all that is what happened in Abu Ghraib. I can just tell you this, and I've got to do the reporting on this, and you have to wait for me to do it. I mean, but it's not about an academic debate in long essays between the Justice Department and the White House, legal essays about where the Geneva Convention ends and the presidential prerogative begins. What we had was a series of massive crimes, criminal activity by the president and the vice president. By this administration, anyway, I can say that. I can't say who did it. The only way to look at this is as war crimes. What happened there, war crimes. And, well, I'm not saying it's there yet. It's not there yet, but that's where it has to go. We have to stop looking at it as some sort of an academic debate about the Geneva Convention and really begin to look at it in terms of who did what, who died, why did he die. Are there people missing? Are we doing what the Brazilians and Argentinians did back two or three decades ago, and actually until this decade? Are we disappearing people? Are there people being tortured knowingly in advance that the torture was going to put their lives at peril and is nothing being done to relieve their suffering and to the point that they die? Is there mens rea? Is there guilty knowledge? Is it a crime? And we're going to get there because I think that's where it's sort of ineluctably going, as you just see on and on and on. And we're not there yet, and I'm not sure I'm not telling you I can take it there. I'm just telling you that that's the way you have to look at it. You have to look at it. And so the yipping, and, you know, I'll tell you what an Israeli told me. And the Israelis, as you know, as a very tough, hard-nosed Israeli told me at one point about all this, he said, you know, we hate the Arabs. This is a guy who spent his career in the intelligence service, and, you know, his hands are bloody. He said, we hate the Arabs. and the Arabs hate us. And before 1948, we've been killing Arabs and they've been killing us. But I have to tell you something, he said. We know somewhere down the line we're going to have to live with these people as much as we can't stand them. They're going to have to be our neighbors. And if we had done in our prisons to the Arabs what you have done to the Arabs in your prisons, we couldn't live that way. And so the bottom line is, we have started something that we don't know the end. The bottom line is about this treatment, and as more details come out, and I can tell you it was much worse, and the government knows it's much worse than they've even told you. There are worse photos, worse videotapes, worse events. To the New Yorker's credit, we decided not for censorship, but just because how much can you levy on Arab manhood in public? But Arabs, I will tell you, it's not just the radicals. And we all know how this policy, this administration's policies in Afghanistan, too, and also, of course, in Iraq, has really done exactly the contrary of what they said they were going to do. They haven't ended the war of terrorism. They've expanded it. There's nothing obvious. That's totally clear. But Arabs now, moderate Arabs, Arabs that normally would be doing the kind of, as you know, the overwhelming, vastly overwhelming percentage of moderate of Arabs deplored what happened to this country in 9/11 as much as anybody here. But those Arabs we've lost, they see us as a sexually perverse society. The sexual stuff we did to them is seen as just perversion. And I think we're going to have consequences for a long time to come. There's an awful lot of respect in the Arab world for Americans. I travel there all the time. And American Jews, even. I wouldn't walk around Baghdad. But most of the world is very safe. We have a lot of problems. So rather than deal with the obvious stuff about Bush and this election and what it means, I think the real question we have to answer, and this is the question I don't have, I'm inchoate about it, I don't have an answer. My friend Dan Ellsberg would say heuristic. I have some heuristic thoughts about it. He's a great expert in heurism. And what is the question we have to say to ourselves is, okay, so here's what happens. A bunch of guys, 8 or 9 neoconservatives, cultists, not Charles Manson cultists, but cultists, get in. And it's not, with all due respect to Michael Moore, and you'll read his movie's fine, but it's not about oil. It's not even about protecting Israel. It's about a utopia they have. It's about an idea they have. Not only about that democracy can be spread. In a sense, I would say Paul Wolfowitz is the greatest Trotskyite of our time. He believes in a permanent revolution, and in the Middle East to begin, needless to say. And so you have a bunch of people who have been, for 10, 12 years, have been fantasizing since the 1991 Gulf War on the way to resolve problems. And, of course, there would be beneficiary. Israel would be a beneficiary, et cetera, but the world in their eyes, this was utopia. And so they got together this small group of cultists. And how did they do it? They did do it. They've taken the government over. And what's amazing to me, and what really is troubling, is how fragile our democracy is. Look what happened to us. We all heard tonight, all of our speakers, directly and indirectly, certainly in the sales movie, about the press and how it's, John Sayles used the word self-censorship, which is the beacon word for me. I always think it comes more from, there is a corporate mentality out there, but there's also a tremendous amount of self-censorship among the press. It's like a disease. But also, they not only they took away the edge from the press, they also muzzled the bureaucracy, they muzzled the military, they muzzled the Congress, and it's an amazing feat. We're supposed to be a democratic society, and all of those areas of our democracy bowed and scraped to this group of neocons who advocated a policy. You know, we all know the story that how mad they got at General Shinseki, who I think is going to run for the Senate in Hawaii and should for Inouye's seat. He's a great general. The important thing about Shinseki to me, and this is just heuristic, I don't know this. The important thing about Shinseki is this. He testifies before the Gulf War, we're going to need a couple hundred thousand troops, and everybody in Wolfowitz and the others, I count Wolfowitz, I lead with him because he's the genius in the background. He's the man with a great, very articulate, very persuasive. And so Shinseki testifies, we need a couple hundred thousand, and everybody's mad at him. It's about 2 weeks before the war. And it made sense. Everybody said they were mad because he's talking about numbers that these guys say you won't need. They're going to go invade Iraq, and you know the story. They were greeted with flowers and all that stuff. We all know that story. But it wasn't that. Their complaint with Shinseki was really much more interesting. It was, didn't he get it? Didn't he know we've been talking about in the tank with the JCS and the generals? Didn't he get it? We could do it with 5,000 troops. We have to make these bargains with these crazy Clintonized generals. I'm talking like Rummy Rumsfeld would talk. These generals who are these soft generals, literally, unfortunately. These Clintonized generals. Didn't Shinseki get it? Doesn't he understand what we're doing here? We did it in Afghanistan. We're going to do it in Iraq. Some special forces, some bombing. We're going to take it over. It's going to be like this. He didn't get it. That was the problem. That's why I had to read him out. He wasn't on the team. And so you have a government that basically has been operating since 9/11 very successfully on the principle that if you're with us, you're a genius. If you're against us, you're not just somebody loyal opposition. You're a traitor. It can't deal with you. I'm exaggerating very slightly. So what does that mean? That means no dissent. Somebody I know went recently was working with the Joint Chiefs of Staff on a budget issue. And the budget's in incredible chaos, the Defense Department budget. Don't hold me to this because this isn't, the New Yorker is this great fact-checking system. This is just something I've heard. But among the problems they have, they can't find something like $1 billion in cash that was known to be in Iraq. They just can't find it. And, we're talking with the B word, they're $1 billion. And so they've got huge problems with their spending. And they were the Joint Chiefs. This is in big league meetings. And then this gentleman has to go and brief his findings. He's an outside expert, done an investigation. He has to brief Rumsfeld. And one of the senior generals, who happens to be a very good guy, not General Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who's known to many generals as hear no evil and see no evil. We have that incredible sort of problem. It's a digression. I wish they had more guts, the 2, 3, and 4 stars. I shouldn't say that because I'm obviously a beneficiary, indirectly. I'm a beneficiary for their thoughts in some cases. But it is sort of sad that none of them have come forward and really blasted away, because I can tell you right now the disaffection inside the Pentagon is really extremely acute. There's never been anything like it. And they feel that this government doesn't care about, a good officer. And I could tell you right now, don't make the mistake of thinking that they're not good people. They are. And in the intelligence service, too, they're people like everybody else. They want to do their job right. They want to do it with as much honor as they can. And this is something that I feel, I know these guys, and they do care. But they also, the good ones also, they're in loco parentis. One of the things they take very seriously, particularly any of you know a Marine, you know what I'm talking about. You give their children to them, they take care of you. They can't do that now in Iraq. And they really don't think we care, and they don't think, they certainly don't think people in the White House care. So there's a lot of we're just beginning a campaign, a political campaign, and we'll get back to it. I don't remember, I lost my thought, but it doesn't matter. Somebody help me out. anyway, so here we are. We have a muzzled world. The money story. Somebody listens. So anyway, so one of the good generals, one of the good guys, goes in and there's a meeting with Rumsfeld, and the person I'm talking about is describing the condition that he's discovered of the budget planning. We're talking about lots of billions of dollars. This war is going to probably end up being the $1 trillion war we can't even begin to estimate the cost. We got a lot, when you see the Moore movie, and in Control Room, when you see those movies, the photographs that are the most gripping are the photographs of Baghdad before the war. And look, and I know he's a bad guy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, Saddam, but still, and the rebuilding. Anyway, the point is that my friend, this person told Rumsfeld how bad things are. Rumsfeld, of course, said in his, oh my God, he said, that's absolutely wrong. He said, there's nothing like that. Then he said, there's no problem with the budget. And he turned to this ranking general and he said, isn't that right? And this general in front of this outsider said, yes, sir, you're right. And that's what happens. That's what you have now. And to me, there's nothing more scary. The Secretary of Defense is simply incapable of hearing what he doesn't want to hear. And he's not the ideologue that Wolfowitz is. You couple that with an ideologue, And I don't know what we can do. I don't know what any of us can do to stop it. I think what's going to happen is the president's, and my guess is, first of all, again, the idea that three networks, or at least two of them, I think, Jenny, I think all three sent their ankle men to Baghdad on the 30th for this transfer of sovereignty. And I just wonder, I mean, how out of touch are they? What sovereignty? What sovereignty do we have to give? There's no phones. There's no electricity. No. This is a sad fact. There is no sovereignty. There's no army. It's a Potemkin village, maybe, yes. So they're going to go inside the CPA where the grass is green and the air conditioning works, and they're going to have a change of command with the press monitoring it. And they had all three anchors there. I thought to myself, wow, it's really scary. we're making the pictures and we're believing them now more than ever. So it doesn't have much reality. So the president's, I would guess, the president's policy is he doesn't have a policy behind the new government, the Alawi government, which is basically a bunch of outsiders taking control, and everybody's got their hands in certain. There's no way this government's going to be acceptable to anybody except a very small minority of people. It's not going to work. It's not going to stop the insurgency. I think you're going to see a lot of efforts to try and paint the insurgency in the next month as increasingly being outsiders. And I've seen already the first showdown between Al-Qaeda and the United States. Al-Qaeda's taken over the insurgency. I don't think that's true at all. And I can tell you right now, I'm telling you, I know. A year ago, a year and a half ago, there was total panic inside because they were the opposition, the insurgency, was operating in 1-, 2-, and 3-man cells, and we knew nothing about them. I can tell you right now, they're operating 10- and 15-man cells right now, and we still know nothing about them. The interrogations haven't worked, no matter how much pressure they put on people. We have no tactical information of any use whatsoever. And if you go to Europe and talk to some of the intelligence people there and some of the people in the Middle East who are our friends, we have many friends, and you know, we're very sad about what's happened to America, are praying for the next election. They will tell you that even this stuff you're hearing about Zakari is Mr. Everybody. He's never liked bin Laden. And it's not clear that the person that we claim responsible for all those acts is he. People who know the Arab world very well and very carefully and listen to his statements. He's a Jordanian. Many of the comments that have alleged to have been in his name are not made by him. In other words, the suggestion is he's a composite figure. He's very convenient. I don't want to suggest to you that we've ever been propagandized by our government, but it's very convenient. It's very convenient to keep on telling the press Zakari's being. My favorite one was that nice kid that was beheaded. Remember, the guy that beheaded him had a hood over, and it was described very confidently by the American establishment government as Zakari. Well, if they can see through hoods. Anyway, so I think the policy is going to be we've got this guy, Alawi, and this government. Let's stand him up and see if he can get past the election. And let's just escalate and bomb and bomb and bomb. And the only answer for these guys is going to be more pressure, more military force. Not only do they have to, you know, we accept as commonplace every day now. We're emulating Israel and the missile attacks, and it's a daily occurrence. We keep on bombing places in Fallujah, claiming we've gotten rid of Zakari, who keeps on showing up anyway, whoever he is. We don't have much intelligence, and we're escalating a war. Bombing, missiles, attacks, much more violence. It just has crept up on us, you know, a little cat paw. And we're there. We're there in a full-scale, increasingly intense military activity, more bombing, more Air Force planes, more ordnance, more shelling, what we call force protection. That is, you're not going to send troops somewhere where you can just fire a lot of missiles, which means, of course, more collateral damage, more civilians, which means, of course, more opposition, more insurgency, what they did at El Garib and other places. Was the people they would torture, and sometimes for an Arab man being photographed without clothes on, in the Quran you're not allowed, this front cannot be exposed, and to be exposed that way and to be forced to simulate sexual activity with other males and have women give the thumbs up sign is the ultimate degradation. It's literally any classic definition of it's torture. Torture isn't always physical. It's a torturous process. And the purpose of it, of course, is to generate information. So what do you get? You get people that know nothing. The ICRC, the International Red Cross, estimated in the prison population in El Garib at the time of the worst abuses, they estimated that upwards of 90% had no bearing at all on anything anti-American or any activity that had anything to do with the insurgency. This wonderful general, Antonio Taguba, the report that I got. And this guy, Taguba's report, estimated that 60% had nothing to do. So you take these people, you expose them to the ridicule and physical torture that you can, and they end up telling you that, yes, they'll give you the names of people in their neighborhood that are al-Qaeda or terrorists, insurgency, and they give you names. And then, of course, they're just names, they're just doing it, and then you arrest those people and bring them in and you start the process, and the circle gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And I would... debating about it. Some of the worst things that happen that you don't know about. Okay? Videos. There are women there. Some of you may have read that they were passing letters out or communications out to their men. This is in El Garib, which is about 30 miles from Baghdad, 30 kilometers maybe, just 20 miles. I'm not sure whether it's... Anyway, the women were passing messages out, say, please come and kill me because of what's happened. And basically what happened is that those women who were arrested with young boys, children, in cases that have been recorded, the boys were sodomized and with the cameras rolling. And the worst above all of them is the soundtrack of the boys shrieking. That your government has. And they were in total terror. It's going to come out. It's impossible to say to yourself, how do we get there? Who are we? Who are these people that sent us there? When I did Milai, I was very troubled, like anybody in his right mind would be, about what happened. And I ended up in something I wrote saying, in the end, I said that the people who did the killing were as much victims as the people they killed because of the scars they had. I can tell you some of the personal stories of some of the people are just who were in these units who witnessed this. I can also tell you written complaints were made to the highest officers. And so we're dealing with an enormous, massive amount of criminal wrongdoing that was covered up at the highest command out there and higher. And we have to get to it, and we will. And we will. I mean, you know, it's just, there's enough out there. They can't. So it's going to be an interesting election year. It is. It's going to be Bush versus Bush, I think, largely, in my view. Not that, you know, not that the Democrats won't have, or Ralph Nader, won't have something to do with it. But it's really going to be, it's Bush running against Bush. And I don't know where we're going to come out. I guess the only thing I can say is that above and beyond that, all of you know, because all of you care about the constitutional rights and what's going on in the government, the issues that many in this organization are deeply involved in, one of the other great shocking examples of self-censorship or just sheer cowardness or what you will is has been the inability of the press corps to deal with the Justice Department and what's happened there. It's one of the great failings. I can tell you the degradation of that place has been so total. And there are people there again. There are many people in those places that really care about human rights. I was getting emails on September the 12th, 2001, from people inside the FBI saying, we are in real trouble with this guy Ashcroft. So there are people there that care. They fight as hard as they can. And it's not as if when you have the kind of leadership we have, I don't know where we go. You know, I just wish I could tell you, I am telling you, go back, do what you can. When you see these movies, when you see this movie and the other movies, and you'll see them all, you're going to say to yourself, as many people have said to me, I better do more. but also be terribly aware that we are so disconnected with this leadership, it's not necessarily clear that what you do is going to impact on them, because these are people that are really out there. And we have really been, you know, it's as I say, it's not the Manson clan, but we really have been taken over. And we have to do something to stop it, and let's hope we can do it electorally.